Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. And that's called Cello Song. It's music from Nick Drake from the album Five Leaves Left. This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special, the night we get someone in to pick the music. And tonight I'm delighted to say that my guest is the cellist and the artistic director of Crash Ensemble, Kate Ellis. Kate, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Delighted to have you here. I've seen you play cello so many times in so many different contexts, which is, you know, what makes you particularly interesting to me as a cellist. You don't just do one thing. But before we get into that, and your choices are great, obviously, it'll reflect that wide interest in music. But first of all, Kate, even though I've known you in Dublin for a very long time, where are you from?
So I was born in Clacton-on-Sea in Essex in England, and I spent my childhood there. And then when it got to the point of where do I go to study and where do I, how do I leave London? I was in London at the time. I went to school in London. I decided to look outside of the country, and there was Ireland to the left and there was France to the right, and then there was Scotland. So I decided I'd go left and come to Ireland.
Any particular reason to come here apart from...
I suppose I'd always had an interest in folk music, in Irish folk music and in English folk music, Scottish folk music. And that kind of drew me towards Ireland, I think. And then when I came, the very first time I came to have kind of some lessons with some of the teachers in the academy in Dublin, and I met the teacher that I then went to study with, William Butt, and we hit it off. We both had the same sort of rebellious nature, I'd call it.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to that because I want to ask you specifically about the studies in a while. But first of all, tell me a little bit about Clacton, because Clacton-on-Sea turns up in various plays and light operas and storybooks as this English seaside resort.
Yeah.
Is it still an English seaside resort?
It is still an English seaside resort. It's very much... a certain particular generation of people who live there. It's kind of a very beautiful small town that's easy to go and retire to.
Yeah.
So,
what county is it in?
It's in Essex.
Essex.
Yep. So there, in during the war, there are a lot of people who were evacuated. A lot of kids who were evacuated. And they were evacuated to Clacton-on-Sea and kind of the surrounding areas. So a lot of those people have then gone on to buy retirement homes in Clacton-on-Sea, and then their children have followed them, and so on and so on. So there's a pretty large population of people from kind of London and the surrounding areas who've moved to Clacton-on-Sea.
And do you know the way a place like Brighton is kind of hip, and Nick Cave lives there? Clacton's not like
Clacton
that.
Clacton is the opposite. Right. Polar opposite of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, music education at a young age in Clacton, with me, was there music in the house? Record player, musicians?
Yeah. So, there was always music in the house. My dad is a photographer, was a photographer. He's now retired. And he worked in London in the early kind of 50s, 60s, where there was a kind of a pool of journalists, and they were all sent out to various newspapers, to work for various newspapers and magazines. Mm-hmm. And he ended up, because he had a really strong interest in jazz and kind of rock music at the time, he ended up taking photos for Melody Maker. He ended up kind of entrenching himself in that kind of scene that was really massive in London at the time. So there was always lots and lots and lots of jazz, like really old Dixieland jazz from my dad's side. Mm-hmm. And then my mum would listen to the radio a lot. She listened to a lot of kind of talk shows on the radio, and she really had a big kind of strong love for classical music. So it's kind of between the jazz and the classical music, and then there was a bit of folk music thrown in there from both of them, actually. They both had an interest in that. So there was a guitar lying around the house, which I remember picking up and kind of strumming a few chords. And then friends would come over who could play the instrument, and they'd kind of show us, you know, different songs and stuff. So,
well, let's have your first musical choice, because I see it as a Divine Sarah, great yes. Sarah Vaughan. Is this someone you would have heard in the house?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, what do you tell us a little bit about Sarah Vaughan in advance? She's this extraordinary singer.
Yep.
I know a singer who once said she was a better singer before she realised she was a brilliant singer.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Once she realised she could do all sorts of things, she started doing all sorts of things.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you make of her?
Well, I think she's amazing. I think it was a hard one to choose between her and Ella, obviously. But I think for me, this has more significance from various conversations with my dad, who's very, very knowledgeable about jazz, and jazz singing would have been kind of specifically an area that he was really interested in. He kind of pointed me in her direction a bit more.
Yeah. A real instrument, as they say.
Yes.
Sarah Vaughan.
Your tea, the memory of all that.
They can't take that away from me. Sarah Vaughan, the Divine Sarah, the first choice tonight of my guest. Kate Ellis is picking all the tunes. So Kate, we were talking about you hearing music you got at home in Clacton.
Yes.
Your instrument, however, and the one on which you made your name and make your living, is the cello. So when did you first find yourself playing a cello?
So I think I was around 10. Yeah, I was 10. And according to my lovely mum, she said that I was listening to something on the radio, and which was Jacqueline du Pré playing whatever she was playing. I don't know what she was playing. And according to my mum, I kind of stopped everything that I was doing and seemed to be really, really, really kind of entranced and fascinated by what I was listening to. And we had a conversation about it afterwards, and you know, she was saying that's the cello and this is who it is, and I said to her that I'd really like to play the cello. So she, as you would do, she kind of called around, asked people she knew, looked for a cello teacher, and they arranged that this lady, Cecily Mortimer, would come to my house and I'd
She
try
sounds
the cello.
About right, Cecily Mortimer.
She was an amazing lady. And
sounds
she
a bit
came,
central casting though for a cello teacher.
She came to the house, and I think she stayed for like a couple of hours. I ate all the information, and I just wanted to keep going and going and going. And she said, "Shall I come back in a couple of days?" So she came back in a couple of days, and she'd found me a cello that I could use, and she then became a very central fixture in our household for the next 2 years, also more than that.
But, I mean, you were only 10.
I was 10.
What was it that appealed to you? I mean, Jacqueline du Pré, was it the sight of her? Was it the sound of the instrument? Was it
to
the
be
whole?
Honest, I actually really can't remember.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I said...
You know, she was a spectacular sight to see when she was playing.
Absolutely,
you know?
Spectacular. But yeah. I hadn't seen her. It was only from listening to the radio.
Right, of course, yeah.
And I don't know what it was. Maybe, you know, maybe as parents you look for every single avenue that you look to pursue every single interest that your child has, and maybe that's kind of where
and
it
were
was.
You playing anything up to that point? You mentioned guitar, but
yeah, so I was kind of messing around with the guitar. We'd sing in school. I was having piano lessons, and I was also learning the recorder in school. There was quite a good kind of music department in the primary school that I was in. So
and
yeah.
By that stage of 10, would you have known the notes, known the dots?
Yeah, I would have done. I would have had a good understanding already of kind of the basics, yeah.
So you're ready to hit the ground running, really, when the instrument came along.
Yeah.
That's why it's important for kids, I think, if they can bear wasting time playing the recorder and so on. Yeah, it is worth it.
It's really worth it. Yeah. Well, it gives you, as you say, it gives you the basic kind of understanding, and then you can jump on the train, as it were, with the instrument that you like or the instrument that you want.
Well, let's hear some Jacqueline Dupre then. What have you chosen, Kate?
So as I said, there's a story to this, is what I'm going to tell you. The cello teacher that I kind of first started with, this amazing, amazing lady who actually studied with William Pleath just before, who was Jacqueline Dupre's teacher, just before Jacqueline Dupre started studying with him. And she'd given up the cello, and she hadn't played in maybe 15 years. And she found an old cello in the attic of a house in the tiny village that she was living for. She was living in, and she then took up the cello. And so it was something really, really special for her to find another cello soulmate, as it were. So she actually took me to London a few times to have lessons with William Pleath, which was where the whole kind of dedication and the "this is what I'm going to do" kind of in my head started, was going to London to see this amazing man who is an unbelievable person, but also an absolutely unbelievable musician. So that's where this comes in.
So what is it?
So this is a duet that I used to play with my teacher. And this is, we used to kind of have a really brilliant relationship where, like I say, she'd come to the house quite a lot. She decided she'd kind of take me on as her sidekick. So she'd come, I'd literally ring her after school and I'd say, "Can you come and we'll play the cello?" So we used to spend a lot of time playing together and playing duets together. And we used to make up a lot of music. We used to make up different ways of playing the cello. She made it kind of fun. She took away from the learning of the notes and the technical side of things. She allowed me to explore the instrument and explore my own musicality, I suppose. So yeah, this is one of the pieces that we...
So you used to play this with your teacher?
I did.
But this is Jacqueline Dupre with her teacher?
Yes.
And what is its music by Couperin?
This is Couperin. It's 13e concert. I don't know how to say that. Anyway, this is it's actually for two viola da gambas, maybe. But this is a transcription for two cellos.
Music there from Jacqueline Dupre and William Pleath together there. And Kate Ellis, my guest, he's choosing all the music tonight. And that's a piece of music, Jacqueline Dupre and her teacher. But Kate used to play that with her teacher, Cecily Mortimer.
I can
just see Cecily Mortimer in my head, straight out of an Oscar Wilde play or something.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly what she was like.
Wow. That thing about teachers, though, particularly in classical music, it seems really important, you know, that you often hear that such and such was taught by such and such, who was taught by such and such, who was taught by Beethoven.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of run through.
That lineage, yeah. It is, though. It definitely is there.
And it's quite, you know, within a few moves, you could be back with Stravinsky very quickly, and then you could be back again.
Quickly. Yeah. Yep.
Anyway, so at that age of 10 and, you know, heading up to your teens and so on, were you overtaken by classical music?
I was. So after I started going up to London to have these lessons with William Pleath, I then auditioned for one of the junior departments in the London schools, so the Royal College of Music. So I think I started at the same time as starting secondary school, I started to go every Saturday to the junior department. So that's how that all started.
And was that to the exclusion of everything else? So let's just concentrate on music for a start. I mean, did it exclude all other forms of music for you at that stage? Because you're it takes a lot of dedication.
So it to my study, as it were, my kind of the path that I was taking and that I wholeheartedly wanted to take was to learn to play the cello and to be a cellist. I think even at that stage, I decided at that point. But having said that, there was still various forms of various genres of music that I was kind of being saturated with at home. As I was talking about my dad earlier on, he was also, and my mum too, we were kind of interested in English folk music. My dad played the box a little bit, and we played for, he kind of played for a Morris dancing team, which we all then started to kind of become involved in. So we would go to folk festivals in England a lot. From the age of maybe 5 or 6, I remember going to this one particular festival called the Rochester Sweeps Festival, which is a big May Day celebration. And we'd spend our summers going to these festivals, and I'd picked up playing the box at that stage, and I was allowed to keep my options open and to keep my ears open to different styles of music.
See, it's interesting that with so much, I'm wondering what Cecily would have made of this, because a lot of teachers do not want the kids with other genres while they're, particularly from the, you know, if they're focusing on classical music, they don't mm-hmm. want them playing anything else. And they kind of discourage it.
She was pretty amazing in the sense that she, I think maybe because she stepped away from playing the cello for such a long time and then she'd come back to it quite recently, quite a short time before I met her, maybe she was thinking in a different way about it. Maybe she knew that actually to absorb all the other, you know, all sorts of other styles of music and people's perceptions of music were probably changing already at that point in time. So I think I was
and
lucky.
What about pop music and rock music and disco and whatever else was going on?
Yeah, well, we were a little sheltered from that, I suppose. I mean, apart from the obvious, you know, tunes going around at school, and there was no internet, there was none of that kind of, it wasn't as readily.
Had you a television?
No.
Yeah, this is common to a lot of people I interview on Sunday nights. There was no television. Sounds like a great idea not to have a television.
Yeah,
I can think of very few good ideas, reasons to have a television.
Yeah, no. Well, my parents had a television, but we didn't watch the television.
That's probably the way to do it. Yeah, you can turn it on for the World Cup final and then turn it off again for the next 4 years. That's how you do it.
That's the way to do it.
So, but even then, though, pop music was not really part of your. And I ask this because you ultimately end up playing with all sorts of people.
Yeah, right? I do. It probably wasn't. The current music, you know, when I was a teenager, I went on to go to a specialist music school where it was kind of like a hothouse of young classical players from all over the world. So that was very, very kind of isolating in a way, and isolated in the sense that the whole ethos of the school was kind of built around being a classical musician and playing classical music. So
your next musical choice is from the folk genre, and it's Michael McGoldrick. I don't know if you've played with Michael, have you? You certainly would
have
shared
yeah.
stages with him, yeah? But you've played on stage with him too, have you?
Yeah, I have. So he actually was one... This I got a CD. One of my very first CDs was something by a band called Fluke, which Michael was part of, and this was back in like the early mid-90s maybe. This was at the stage where I was in this kind of hothouse of a classical music school, but I kind of started to veer more and more towards going to these folk festivals, and I kind of created my own world with different musicians of my own age who were going to these folk festivals. There was a big following of people who kind of traipse around to all these different festivals. And this particular band, Fluke, I remember really distinctly doing a workshop with them where I was playing the box and I was playing the cello. And it just struck me, it's something that's kind of remained with me still, at how kind of, I don't know what's the word, how easy how easy the music sounded and how it was really, 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 you know, finely tuned and finely nuanced and really actually incredibly complicated. But from a listening perspective, it's just so simple and so easy to absorb. And it was kind of, it was a big relief for me, actually, because I was in the middle of, you know, learning complicated harmony and, you know, studying Bach and studying Beethoven. And suddenly to have this kind of really visceral experience of these absolutely amazing musicians sitting in front of me playing and teaching me their music. Yeah, it was amazing.
Okay, so this is Michael McGoldrick and, well, a few tunes here. We'll go over them when we get back. Michael McGoldrick there, and Lochmount and Paddy Finlay's Dan Breen's Reel, the choice of Kate Ellis, is with me in studio tonight picking all the tunes. Kate, when you were going to those folk festivals and playing, sitting in with those musicians and playing that kind of music as well, you had the box and did you bring the cello as well?
I did, yeah. It wasn't so portable. Yeah. That was the thing. And also we would be camping and it would get very wet.
Need
and
a tent
damp
of its own.
And yes.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm thinking is, you know, if you're hanging out with those musicians, was there ever a temptation just to, yeah, forget the cello, bring the box, have a good time, forget about Bach even, forget about all the rest of it, forget about the studies, forget about Beethoven and theory and just play?
I think I knew I had to finish school first.
Yeah.
That was kind of the priority, was to actually just get through to the end of school and then I could, you know, see what else was out there.
Well, did the musics clash? Did you start to think, you know, one of them is a study, one of them is something I have to do, the other one is obviously a great time?
I suppose no. I suppose in the back of my head, it was always back to the cello. It was always back to the cello. And I think maybe I knew that doing all those things and not doing all this, I think maybe I knew that going to hear all those musicians, and I knew that for me, it was kind of really inspiring. And in turn, that would infiltrate into my playing. I think I understood that it was in itself, it was an education.
And were you always musically open-minded in the way I know you are now? Or was that very important to meet those people? Because clearly when you listen to that, they're traditional musicians who are listening to everything from Earth, Wind and Fire to whatever hip-hop records were out at the time. There's a DJ in there as well as the horn section and everything. They were clearly open-minded and didn't...
Yeah.
You know, did that produce the open-mindedness in you, or was it always there, do you think?
I have a feeling it was always there. And I think, again, maybe it's because I've always been a little bit of a rebel. And I think it actually really came about when I first took up the cello and when I was really, really allowed. And I think as a kid, you need to be allowed to kind of, you have no barriers and you have no knowing of where the wall is and where the line is. And I think as a kid, as a child playing the cello, I was allowed to really explore it and really kind of, I suppose, put my stamp on it. And I think that's where it came from. And then all the other stuff that, you know, all the other music that I was listening to, the other musicians I was meeting, I think that kept informing that information that I was thankfully given when I was 10, 11.
Now, while those tunes were playing there, we were having a conversation about how funky they were and how much funk and different rhythms exist in folk music.
Yeah,
and they can bring them out. They're there. And then I mentioned Bach.
Yeah.
And how, you know, the Modern Jazz Quartet and others have done jazz versions of Bach. And then there's the Swingle singers and all these sorts of things.
Mm.
And there's a lot of funk and Bach and swing and all that's all in there. Yeah. If you wanted to go and get it. And you said, ah, but Bach is sacred.
Yeah.
Now, are you serious about that? You don't touch Bach.
Well, I think you don't need to touch Bach. Hmm. I think you just need to let it be.
Oh, well, I agree with you, but would it be wrong to...
No, not at all. It would never be wrong. But just from a personal perspective, I think it's just something that needs to be... It just needs to sit by itself and do its own thing.
Well, see, it's more than enough by itself, isn't it?
Exactly. Because
it's monumental. There's so much of it for a start. You'll never get around to hearing all of it.
Yeah.
And it's all mind-blowing.
Yeah, it is.
But what the temptation, though, is for me is because I hear so many musicians from all sorts of backgrounds, particularly jazz people.
Yeah.
And people involved in hip-hop and all the rest of it said, oh, I love Bach. Bach is the one that they all go for. What is it about him that's so appealing to people from various backgrounds, traditional musicians
I think it has something to do with the form of it. I think the written form of it and the... I don't know. That's a tricky one, John. I think the written form of it and the simplicity of it makes it appealing. It's very structured. It's very A-B-A-B or A-A-B. It's kind of a recognisable form without even having to know anything about form or without even kind of... knowing about musical structure in classical music or any other kind of music. I think it's also really satisfying.
Yeah.
It kind of does something, progresses somewhere, and then it finishes really clearly and it's really clean and it's just really amazingly packaged and just beautifully crafted.
Do you think there's something in us as humans that recognise patterns, even if we're not even aware of recognizing them, but we do find them satisfying?
I do. I think everybody recognizes them.
Yeah. But you know, when you see those, there's a few these wonderful graphic realizations, whatever you call it, of Bach's music online, where you see how they move forward and then they move backwards on top of each other and then they turn over
and then they turn over.
And they're backwards. And But I think somehow you kind of instinctively pick that up without even understanding it.
I think you do,
That might explain Bach then. Yeah. If we've done nothing else tonight.
We've explained Bach.
If we've done nothing else tonight, that's it. So you want to hear some Bach.
Yeah.
And Glenn Gould. Sometimes, you know, people who have no classical music at all have Glenn Gould's performance of the Goldberg variations. But you've gone for the English suite.
I have.
Number one. Why that?
This was actually something that was in the house when I was growing up. And it's something that I kind of took with me and I still have with me for... my kind of, I don't know, I wouldn't listen to it that often, but I remember there was a period of time when I actually probably listened to it every day.
And Glenn Gould?
Yes, always.
Has to be Glenn Gould.
Has to be, yeah.
Glenn Gould on piano and Bach's English Suite number one, the Allemande. I've got that right, Kate, haven't I?
Yes.
The Allemande. Okay. So we've had Bach and we've had Michael McGoldrick and we have Jacqueline Dupré and we've had Sarah Vaughan. So that's a fairly healthy growing up to music.
Yeah.
And no television.
Nope. Apart from Star Trek.
Yeah. But that's all right. That's
that was
good.
Like... The key was like when we were about 11 or 12, they were like this. They said, you can watch the Channel 4 news on a Friday.
Yeah.
And then we were like, this is really boring. And they said, okay, you can watch Star Trek.
Well, they were right.
On a Tuesday.
They were right.
They were absolutely right.
Because I always preferred Star Trek to Star Wars, for instance.
Oh, yeah, Star Trek.
Huge.
Captain Kirk.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't a Trekkie.
The, like the wobbly scenery.
I mean, I wasn't a Trekkie. I didn't dress up or anything.
You don't know the whole dialect, do you?
But, no, the Klingon. No, I don't speak. I don't speak. I can barely speak English. So, you came to Dublin to study. You mentioned William Butt, who's a recording artist in his own right.
He has
recorded, I've got stuff by him, Benjamin Britten in particular. And now you, when you arrived in Dublin to study cello, did you have any ideas of your own, or do you, basically in that situation, do you just have to go along with the course? I mean, at that point, you're still learning, really.
Yeah, it was very much, it's very structured. I'm not sure how structured it is still, and they should, anyway. But at the time, you'd have kind of repertoire that you'd have to learn in, say, within the 9 months of a year, you'd have to learn a Bach suite, you'd have to have your technical studies, you'd have to have, you know, a sonata by Beethoven, and then you'd have to have whatever else it would be for that particular year of the syllabus. And you'd spend your year studying those pieces, and then you'd have an exam at the end of the year, and that would be then moving on to the next year.
And you were happy enough to do that?
Well, I knew I kind of had to.
Mm. Discipline.
And discipline. And, you know, weekly lessons, I think it was twice weekly actually, and oral classes and theory classes and orchestra every week and various kind of forms of chamber music and chamber orchestra. So there was a lot of, it was kind of going through the paces and, you know, learning the skills, the learning more of the skill set. That
see, the
was
thing is, when there would have been other musicians of exactly the same age as you,
mm-hmm.
who maybe grew up playing electric guitar, or drums, or whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
and if they had half the chops that you would have had at that stage, they would have been. They've gone. They're off on their own. They've got a band. Yep. They've got a record deal.
Yeah,
they're already away.
They're already gone.
And I just wonder, you know, is it hard to maintain the discipline of studying and studying and studying, when part of you must be saying to yourself, I'm not a bad musician at this stage, you know?
Yeah, I think it's maybe something that's just, maybe it's an antiquated system, or maybe there's something within the system, within the formal system of learning classical music, that there's the idea that you'll always keep learning, and you'll always be learning more, and there'll always be something that you don't know about your instrument or that you can learn from someone else. So I think that that's probably the starting point. The other part of it is that there are so few opportunities for classical musicians in reality. And I think a lot of people, a lot of teachers and a lot of institutions understand that they have to train their students to a certain point where they're able to leave college, and then they're able to present themselves for an audition for an orchestra or an orchestral job, and then off they go. And then they have a steady income, they have a steady job.
And what did you want to be at that point?
Well, I think I was just kind of surviving at that point, actually. And I was, again, I was on this conveyor belt, but then I was kind of... I was always looking to the left and looking to the right. And I was incredibly fortunate to meet some very amazing musicians. One of the first musicians I met, actually, when I say amazing musicians, I mean musicians that I wasn't working with in college, not classical musicians. One of the first people I met was Adrian Crowley, actually, the mm-hmm. singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. And I started to play with him. And then I don't know how, but I started to meet a lot of jazz musicians. So I started to actually play with Justin Carroll and mm-hmm. Dave Redmond and George Higgs. And we had a little group called Triple Piglet, where we played the music of John Zorn.
Ah, now where did you come across John Zorn? Because this is serious stuff now.
Yeah.
This is not, you didn't learn John Zorn when you were learning the recorder in Clacton.
Nope.
And was that, do people discover John Zorn through the education system? That is, if you don't live in New York?
Yeah, no, they don't.
Yeah. I mean,
this is where I'm really, really lucky, and I am very thankful to all these lovely people. But this is where it was really important for me to keep my eyes open and to keep my ears open and to meet people like Justin Carroll, who's now living in New York. But he was a brilliant jazz musician it's a very small, as you know yourself, it's a very small world. The jazz scene in Dublin, as we hear, is very, very small. So once you kind of start meeting these people and going to gigs, you start meeting and hearing other people play. So
John Zorn, I heard once play where I actually thought, this was the lineup. It was John Zorn on sax, Lou Reed on guitar, and Laurie on violin, Laurie Anderson.
Where was it?
And I felt, this was in New York, and I honestly felt like someone was sawing off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
It was the
like
most,
this.
Absolutely, it was the most aggressive, violent, music. I know, no, this isn't.
Yeah.
But the most, it was unbelievable. It was.
Yeah.
Would you please stop?
Yeah, stop. Yeah.
But a great composer, John Zorn.
Yeah.
Really great composer. And
yeah.
you want to play something for with the Masada String Trio, which is a whole series of CDs.
Yeah. So there's a whole. I think there's two. They're called the Book of Angels.
Yeah.
And there's this is some of the music. It was kind of my first introduction to really amazing string players who were improvising. And when I say they were improvising, they were not like the old kind of Stefan Grappelli, not that style of improvisation, but something that was way more akin to the music that I would have been maybe studying or maybe listening to, like a little bit of contemporary music. There was a lot of kind of alternative techniques in the way that they'd improvise. They'd use a lot of kind of, almost distorted sound. And but then, you know, very amazing, beautiful, melodic kind of jazz improvisation.
And what have we got here with
Mehalot.
Here we go. Music there from John Zorn, and that's the choice of Kate Ellis, who's with me in studio tonight. Kate's picking all the music. John Zorn there with Eric Friedlander, who's done exactly what you're doing tonight, Kate, on this show, and Mark Feldman, the Masada String Trio. It's amazing stuff, isn't it?
It is amazing.
Yeah. So it must be great for, you know, a string player when you are being, you know, drilled through the repertoire to find out that there are other ways of doing things, you know.
It is brilliant.
Yeah. Liberating.
Yes.
But had you done the more edgy, the more modern of the classical composers as well? I mean, had you been studying, Berg or, you know?
No, not really. The thing about the structure of the course that I was on, and it's as I say, it's very much geared for kind of orchestral musicians. And so the repertoire is quite limited in terms of picking the classics and, you know, going through the, which is an amazing thing to do, learning all the Bach suites, learning all the Beethoven sonatas, learning Brahms sonatas, learning all the really kind of classic repertoire. Mm. So it hadn't really crept into my consciousness, as it were, yet.
Mm. So what moved you on in that sense musically, that, you know, ultimately you end up performing music by Steve Reich and all the rest of them?
So I started to, I think in my third or my fourth year, I started to take the composition module. I'd done quite a lot of composition when I was in school, and I actually loved it. But then I put it aside until my third or fourth year in college. And as part of that course, we had a really kind of quick flash education into contemporary classical music, as it were. So I suppose it started to creep in there more so. And then, like I say, listening to and, you know, playing the music of people like John Zorn, that also kind of pushed me in that different direction of, it's, for me, it was like a whole different kind of sound world and a whole different way, again, a different way of kind of using your instrument and producing non-traditional sounds on your instrument. So I think the combination of the two kind of pushed me more in that direction.
And at that point, you know, had you decided the conveyor belt is not for me, I don't want to be in an orchestra, or had the conveyor belt thrown you off, or did nobody want you, or whatever?
I think I decided the conveyor belt wasn't for me when I was about 11.
Right, okay. Right.
I was on the conveyor belt, but I decided I was never actually going to be on the conveyor belt for
you
this.
See, you know, you could, you know, all over the world tonight there are going to be orchestras playing.
Yeah.
In various situations.
Yeah.
Whether they're playing for a musical or they're playing, you know, Beethoven.
And they're amazing.
And they're all amazing.
Yeah, they are amazing.
But it's probably the case that every cellist sitting there at one point wanted to be Jacqueline Dupre, you know?
Probably.
And none of them are.
Yeah.
So it's a really difficult world, isn't it?
I mean, it is.
And then of course, I mean, making a living, of course, that's a reality. But you see it in New York, for instance, you in particular, because it's more obvious there. But you'll see a musician who's playing in the pit in some Broadway musical.
Yeah.
Later that night, he turns up for the final set in a jazz club, and he turns out to be the best sax player you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah,
and
there you go.
He certainly had no chance to display that earlier on in the evening. He might also be playing in the house band of a TV show in the afternoon.
Yep, absolutely, and
maybe teaching in the morning.
Yeah,
it's kind of extraordinary and in a place like New Orleans, that's very evident. Yep. All those people who are stunning musicians, they're all teaching.
Yeah,
in and out of schools.
Yeah.
Three or four different gigs.
Yeah.
Some of those gigs they don't want to do.
Yeah.
But that's a musician's life, really, isn't it?
It is.
But anyway, you were off the conveyor belt from the age of 10.
Yes, very much so.
But you still didn't know what you wanted to do.
No, I didn't. I still don't know what I want to do.
That's good. That's probably good, isn't it? But you didn't really know what you wanted to do. But I guess when you fall into the company of other musicians who are similar, like-minded people.
Yeah.
When did Crash begin, actually?
So I began with Crash.
Yeah.
I was in my final year of college and I had a phone call asking me to come and play, I think it was Gerard Barry and Magnus Lindberg, maybe.
Right.
And I got the music and I absolutely ate it up. And then went into this very professional workplace and I was so satisfied and it was as though something kind of clicked into place. I'd found an environment and a type of musical world that I just totally understood and made sense for me. I could put my input into it and I didn't feel in any way restrained and like I had to be kind of I didn't feel like a copycat. I didn't feel like I was trying to emulate the sound of someone playing a Beethoven sonata. I'd suddenly found this kind of music that was really, really new, brand new music. And
it was your final year, however.
I think so,
That can be a bad time to find something else, which is very exciting. Did you finish?
I did finish, yes.
I know, okay. We're going to take a quick break, actually, Kate. And when we come back, we'll talk about Steve Reich.
Yes.
And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night show where we get someone in to pick the tunes. And tonight it's the musician, the cellist, Kate Ellis, who's also artistic director of Crash Ensemble. Kate's picking all the music tonight. Kate, we're halfway through the show and we've only just left Trinity.
I know.
So that's we're getting there.
Are we getting there?
Well, you decided to finish your degree, which is a good idea.
That was a very good idea.
But you had discovered there was another world of music out there that you could really get involved in. There's no one word for it, really, is there? People call this new music.
New music, classical, contemporary music. Mm. Who knows? It's music. It's all music.
But you had been working with Adrian Crowley and Justin Carroll and a band called Your Rodney.
Yes.
Which I remember fondly, which again had that Masada string quartet kind of vibe off them. But then I remember Steve Reich arrived. Do you remember this?
I do. It was the Living Music Festival.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And only some weeks ago on the program, we were talking to Bryce Dessner about what it was like working with Steve Reich.
Yeah.
And, you know, Steve's a great man, but, you know, he knows exactly, as is correct,
yes,
how his music ought to be played.
He does.
And there was you charged with playing the cello.
Yes,
cello counterpoint,
yeah.
Which ain't easy.
No.
But I think I've told you this before. When you were done,
yeah,
I happened to be sitting beside him. Yes, you do. With the world's greatest composers. And he said, I'm really pleased. He said, that piece is going to live now. Boy, by which he meant, you know, here's someone can play this.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you write difficult music, the problem is nobody will be able to play it and it will die.
Yeah.
It will fade away.
Yeah.
But so what was it like when you meet Maestro Reich?
Yeah.
And you start to play, because, you know, rehearsals are fraught.
Yeah. I was actually petrified. Oh. But I was pretty naive. So I was also really, really, really incredibly focused on just playing the piece. I met him in the dressing room of the Belvedere College, and he came in and I was about to go and play. And I was kind of focused enough that I didn't get too distracted. It was only after I'd played and then subsequently meeting him that I kind of had a bit of a reaction.
I mean, he's a lovely man.
He is lovely, yeah.
He really is a lovely man.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's got this, his aesthetic is very, very straight and clear.
Yes.
And you might think, you know, well, I'm playing this, sounds all right to me.
Yeah. And he might think the opposite.
And it might sound all right to everybody else, but it's not actually correct.
Yeah.
It's not correct, and he wants it correct.
He does.
Now, you've chosen a piece of music from Steve Reich, not the cello counterpoint, but electric counterpoint.
Yes.
Now, tell me about, is this, I don't know which version it is, Pat Metheny plays this on the Hayes
album. I don't know which one you had. We'll find out.
We'll play one of them anyway. So what is it about electric counterpoint, or indeed any of those counterpoints that he wrote? What is it about?
Well,
them?
I think for me, this one in particular, it's just I love the funkiness of it. Mm. And I love the bass line when it comes in. And I was trying to pick a piece by Steve, and it's really tricky. I found it really, really difficult to kind of hone in on which one kind of I had the most affinity with, but I think I've actually listened to this so much. I kind of know it inside out, and I haven't grown tired of it.
Do you think it might be the part of you that loves Bach is the same part of you that loves Steve Reich?
I think so.
Yeah, patterns.
Patterns.
They're all there. Okay. Yep. Electric counterpoint, the third movement, the fast movement.
Yes.
From Steve Reich, Electric Counterpoint, the fast movement, played there by Pat Metheny, the choice of Kate Ellis, who's with me in studio. What's it like playing a Steve Reich piece on stage? You know, from the audience's point of view, you know how tough it must be for the musician, even stamina-wise, even keeping the beat for that long. Your arms are about to fall off, you know, when you're shaking maracas or whatever. What's it like for you? I mean, can you even for a second start to take any pleasure in it or enjoy it? Or
oh, totally. You just really can't zone out. You have to be really, really incredibly focused, and you have to, there's no room for distraction, and there's no room for
you're not going to wink at the audience halfway through it or anything.
No. Or your fellow comrades
on
stage. No.
And when it's over, are you exhausted or exhilarated or what?
Not really exhausted. I'd say more exhilarated. Mm. Yeah.
So, I mean, if Steve called now and said, would you do X, Y and Z, would you jump at it? Yeah.
I would.
Every time.
Jump out of this room and onto the airplane.
Great. No, it has crossed my mind. I've seen his music performed a lot now, and there are times when I feel so, I'm so sorry for the musicians in some ways. That sounds very patronising.
But you shouldn't feel sorry for the musicians.
Well, not sorry. Sorry is not the word. I worry for them.
Yeah.
Do you know, that four organs piece yeah. and there's a guy in the middle with maracas who's just keeping this beat for must be 25 minutes or something, and you think, this is awful. How can you do that?
I think the key actually is that you have to let your ego go with his music. You have to let your ego go way out of the door, and you have to realise that you're one part of a big wheel that's turning around, and everyone is a very important, extremely important part, but of this one big massive wheel. And if you understand that, then you can really, really get into it, and you can really get the most out of it. But if you don't get the fact that you're part of this big moving cog, if you don't understand that part, then it doesn't work.
Tell you, it's amazing stuff though. Okay, Donna Cadenahy.
Yes.
Very much associated with Crash Ensemble. He's flying now, isn't he? He's in Princeton. He's recognised.
Absolutely, rightly so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it the old thing? Did he have to go to America for that to happen or what?
Maybe he did. Yeah. Maybe he did actually have to go to America. I think maybe he had to go to America to be able to do what he does. Maybe to be able to write and function. Yeah.
But what was it like though for all of you guys, Crash, Donica, the rest of you, operating in Dublin? I mean, for certain situations, you're the go-to guys.
Yeah.
But how many situations are there in a way? You know, I mean, you make your own work, you come up with your own projects and your own festivals and all the rest of it, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're doing something in a country that's not exactly set up for it.
Not really. I think that's part of... So Donica was one of the founders of Crash, and I think he's always said that he founded it because he primarily needed a vehicle for his own music. So I think he created this group of musicians who he could then write for, he could keep writing for. They would be entrenched in his music and his sound world, and he'd have an outlet for all this composition and you know, pieces of work that he'd heard when he was in Holland and America, and he'd bring them to this group of musicians who'd then kind of absorb the music.
And you're going to play some music from Donica now, which I guess you're probably playing on, right?
Yes.
Grog's Boss. I played this in its entirety on the radio when I did the afternoon show. And it certainly split the constituency. Some thought it was the most amazing thing that I ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
And some thought, what's going on?
Yeah.
Irlo Lennard is singing on it.
He is.
And an incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, he's really pushing it.
Yep.
And we're going to play an extract from it. So there we had part of Grog's Boss from Donna Cadenahy with Irlo Lennard singing, Crash Ensemble performing. Alan Pearson, is it?
Yes, Alan Pearson conducting.
Tell me, how did you meet him? Because again, he's someone I first saw performing with Steve Reich a lot. He seemed to be Reich's guy. You know? And then he ended up working a lot with you guys.
Yeah, so actually that was the first time we met Alan. He came to conduct as part of the Steve Reich Festival. In 2006, I think, around that time.
I forget.
Sometime around then.
It's all a blur.
Yeah. So that was the first time we had actually worked with Alan, who's brilliant, and he understood where Steve was coming from and what he wanted to get out of his music.
Mm-hmm. And it must have been great for you too, because it linked you guys up to the rest of the planet as well, you know.
Very linked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned there Kate, how, you know, Donica, you know, the thinking behind Crash at the beginning was someone to play my music, you know,
yeah.
And you have to create your own opportunities in this business, you know, particularly in the line of music that you're in.
Yeah.
Tell me, where did Kaleidoscope fit into that? This was a regular weekly event.
It still is.
Still is.
Yeah, it's going to be, so it's going to be 10 years in September.
It's a very open-minded,
yeah,
interesting collection of, yeah, musicians and a good repertoire.
So Kaleidoscope was set up basically because the performance opportunities in the city, probably in all types of music, but for myself and the violinist who set it up, they were kind of limited, and there wasn't really a place that people could go. There wasn't really kind of a community of people who could, who loved music, who could go, who loved all types of music, who could go somewhere and listen to, listen and kind of explore different types of music. So we decided that every month we would take over the Odessa and we'd put on a night of music, but we were kind of very specific about what we did. We picked basically all our friends, and we picked on them and we said, what would you like to play? And what would you like to present to, you know, of your new music? Is there something that you'd really love to play, but you never had the opportunity to play it? And would you like to come and perform? And I think at the time there was an appetite for it, and people jumped at the chance to, you know, swing out their, I think I remember, actually maybe it was Malachy Robbins. He at one point had a song that he'd written, so he came and he played the song that he'd written, and I remember it was an opportunity for me to kind of say to all these people that I'd been meeting along my way, come and show your you know, your music and your styles of music to all these other people who haven't heard it, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a melting pot of all musicians, actually musicians from all over the country. And we also had, you know, musicians who were visiting doing gigs. They'd come and they'd do like a little kind of preview of what they were up to. But it
for
was,
the audience, I think, you know, when you get to trust people, you,
yeah,
know, and trust Kaleidoscope as a concept.
Yeah.
And I see that, you know, next month you're performing a piece by, I don't know, Foray or something, you know,
yeah,
you go, okay, this is probably good, or they wouldn't be doing it. This,
yeah,
this is going to be worth.
Yeah. But
worth
also I think there was kind of, you know, there's a lot of people taking a big chance. They'd recognize Foray on the menu, and then they'd come and they'd hear Enderbates doing an electronic set.
Mm. Yeah.
So,
well, it works on the Jules Holland principle. You know, you sit down to watch Jules Holland, you might know any of the bands,
exactly,
but the chances are you're going to get something from all of them.
Yeah, you might love it, you might hate it,
yeah,
but that's all good.
Yeah.
It's all good.
All good. Okay. Next choice is Bwilla, Dog à l'Orange. Curious Orange. Dog à l'Orange. Serious playing on that. That's Bwilla there, and Duck. I was going to say Duck. Dog à l'Orange from the choice of Kate Ellis is with me in the studio. The performance with other people, and this,
yes,
and I would have come across you in numerous situations and go, oh God, Kate's playing in the band, or Kate's doing.
Yeah.
When you're working, and your next choice is Gavin Friday. When you're working with Gavin, how does something like that come about? Normally.
Normally, who knows is the question. Is the answer to that question? Gavin, I actually met. He came and worked with Crash back in 2000 and something early, and he came and did a performance as part of a gig with Gavin Bryars, and I kind of had I had a really lovely moment with Gavin where I think everyone, I kind of didn't quite know what to make of him. And then I remember one night we were going for dinner in, you know, in the middle of rehearsals, we kind of all went for dinner, and I asked him, did he want to come for dinner with us? And he kind of then started chatting away to me, and we had a great, we had a really great time. And then I think a couple of months after, he asked me to come and be part of a show that he was putting on in Liberty Hall, which I said yes, because I think he is brilliant. And having absolutely no idea what the show was going to be, and then landed myself in a rehearsal room with people that I didn't know, and had a great week and did a great show, which was called Tomorrow Belongs to Me.
You've worked with Gavin quite a bit since, actually.
Yeah, I still work with Gavin. I think he's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And
he's the real thing.
He kind of throws curveballs every time I work with him. He throws me a curveball, which I like. Keeps me on my toes. And
what would that be? What would the nature of that curveball be?
Because it could be any nature of curveball you like.
Well, you know, sometimes if someone from, now Gavin's not strictly speaking what you might call a pop music guy. What is he? You know, he's everything.
Exactly.
But the point is, someone from that world might be inclined to think, well, you know, here comes a cellist and I'll kind of bow to their superior knowledge in some way. But Gavin wouldn't do that.
No, he's not like that at all.
So he'd tell you what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He does.
This is what I want. Fair enough. Now, you've chosen a track from an album called Each Man Kills the Thing He Loved. Each Man Kills, called Rags to Riches.
Yes.
This is Gavin Friday. There from Katie Kim with the Crash Ensemble. I think, actually, if I remember correctly, when Katie Kim was on the show doing this, she may have played that.
Did she now?
I think when she was talking about Crash Ensemble, I think. And before Katie Kim, we had Gavin Friday, who will also be doing this show very soon.
Very good. I look forward to it.
You played Gavin from the album Each Man Kills the Thing He Loves and Rags to Riches, Gavin Friday and the Man Caesar. Morris.
Yes.
So this is Mystery Train. My guest tonight is Kate Ellis. She's picking all the music. I just want to get in as much music as we can in the time that's left of us, Kate. So let's just fire ahead with the next choice, which is so terrifying looking. I'm not even sure. I want to. Fausto Ramatelli.
Ramatelli.
Yes. Ictus Ensemble. Professor Bad Trip.
Lesson one.
Is there anything?
Shall I tell you about it?
The audience needs to know.
Shall I tell you why?
Yeah, tell me why.
So this is a piece that I've kind of has been on my radar for very, very, very many years. I wanted to play something that kind of gave an insight into what I actually listen to.
Oh, what does that mean in relation to what we've just been doing?
I know. No, I wanted to play something that kind of gave an example of what my part of my kind of thinking behind programming music, where it comes from, and actually the kind of the extremes that it goes to. I often, when there's small people gone to school, I often sit in my room with the computer and I lose myself in a rabbit hole, the YouTube rabbit hole and the Spotify rabbit hole. And this is a piece that, it's a very long piece, but this is only the first part of the piece that we, I finally got to program as part of the New Music Dublin Festival in March of this year.
So again, just to get the title right, the title of the piece is Professor Bad Trip. And it's composed by, is it? Fausto Ramatelli. And performed by the Ictus Ensemble. Okay.
Professor Bad Trip, Lesson 1. Thank you.
That's called Professor Bad Trip, the Ictus Ensemble, music composed by Fausto Romitelli, the choice of Kate Ellis. So Kate, you program that because a big part of what you do is to program music for festivals and so on, and indeed for Crash.
Yes.
As the artistic director.
Massive part of what I do. So my life entails, as I said, going down lots of rabbit warrens on Spotify and YouTube.
That sounds like a lot of fun, really.
It kind of is a lot of fun.
And then you just approach people and say, would you like to do something for us? Or?
Yes.
Well, maybe now. Why don't we play the little Nico piece now?
Oh, yeah.
I shouldn't call it little. It probably spent years composing
it. So this is a 90-second whirlwind, as described by the man himself. This is part of our Crash Ensemble's Crashlands project,
yeah,
which was a celebration of 20 years of the ensemble.
So Nico... And again, he's been in here in front of me and I'm still not sure whether it's Muley or Muley.
Muley.
Muley. Is that definitive? Definitive?
No.
Okay. Here's Nico. Nico Muley. And this is you guys playing it, obviously, the Crash Ensemble.
Yeah, this is, yeah.
It's called In As Long As It Takes. Music there from Nico Muley, the choice of Kate Ellis, and that indeed was Kate Ellis herself with Crash Ensemble, and a piece called In As Long As It Takes, especially commissioned by yourself.
Yes.
Very good. Now, in the time left to us, we've time to play two more pieces of music. One of them, Sam Amadon.
Yes.
He's kind of like you, isn't he? Because he is one of those musicians who moves between various worlds very, very easily.
Yeah, he does.
And it struck me, he did the show as well, actually. And one, he talked about how his main influences growing up were, and this seems bizarre, but it all made sense then when he explained it, mountain music, hollering mountain music, and free jazz.
When you listen to his new album, it totally makes sense. When you listen to all of it,
But you know what I mean? Mountain music and free jazz, what have they got in common? And then he told me what they had in common just straight off, you know? No problem at all.
Yep.
Interesting guy.
And fascinating.
This is a track called Ghosts.
This is, I've actually been listening to this album loads. I love it.
The Following Mountain.
Yeah, it's his latest album.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great one of my favourite albums, actually. I love it. This is called Ghosts from Sam Amadon. Sam Amadon from the album The Following Mountain, a track called Ghosts, the choice of Kate Ellis. You know, he is exactly, when you know, the more I think about it, the sort of musician that you would like, because he's basically a folk musician, but like, I mean, what's that?
Yeah, that's exactly. He goes to the extreme. He goes to all sorts of extremes, and he kind of mixes. He's not afraid to take any risks whatsoever in his music, which is, I love it.
You can't be not taking risks.
No.
Tell me a little more before you go about the Crashlands album. Sounds like a great, great idea. And, you know, are people receptive to that kind of approach? I guess they are. They love the idea.
Yeah, so the whole project was a big undertaking. And yesterday we released the album of all these 20 commissioned works, and we also released 20 short videos of the 20 premieres of the pieces of work.
And what sort of names have we got on this album?
So we have 10 Irish composers and 10 international composers, and they're people that we've had a relationship with, people that we would like a relationship with, and people that we love and people whose music we play a lot. So there's the Bangona Can trio, there's Nico, there is Gerard Barry, there's Donica Dennehy, Linda Buckley.
Oh, terrific. And that was released yesterday.
Yesterday.
Good timing. Okay, your final choice, Kate, and it's Martin Hayes.
Yes.
Now, Martin Hayes seems to be, for so many musicians now, sort of real touchstone of a figure, you know?
Yeah. I've been doing quite a kind of sporadic work with Martin, and he's actually someone I've listened to a lot. I was given a CD of his when I was in my early 20s, maybe, and it's something, again, something I kind of refer back to a lot. And I think it's simple and it's beautiful and it's beautifully crafted and beautifully nuanced. And
he's taken risks too, isn't he? I mean, I've heard the stuff he's done with the string quartet.
Yeah, with the Brooklyn Rider.
The Brooklyn crowd as well. I mean, that's a couple of things he's done in that area.
He's very interested in kind of pushing people and pushing himself and seeing how far he can push a really simple melody and what he can do with a really simple melody and how he can kind of craft it.
And the track you've chosen,
or
the choice, I mean, there's probably a couple of tunes rolled into one here, is there?
There's two, yeah.
There's two. I'm trying to find it, actually. Oh, yeah, The Hole in the Hedge and A Jig, Seamus Cooley's. This is the one with his dad, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the one. So it's Martin and his dad and Dennis.
And Dennis is there too. And this comes from the album Under the Moon. It's a great title from Martin Hayes. Kate Ellis, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for picking all these fine tunes. We've learned a lot.
Yes.
And that album, which is called, one more time, what's it called?
Crashlands.
Crashlands from Crash Ensemble and various others, released yesterday. Congratulations. Kate, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.